At home, my quote that I was going to bring. I thought it was appropriate for today because it was a Martin Luther King quote. And it also was appropriate for our theme for these weeks because he talked about suffering. And what I remember from the quote is he says, "We shall meet your capacity to inflict suffering with our capacity to endure it." And as you know, it was tremendously powerful in the late 50s and early 60s to have people in America who are willing to endure, to sit there and not flinch, not move, not run away or not attack in response to suffering inflicted to them. And I met one person who was part of the civil rights movement, and she tells a story of going down, you know, I apologize, I don't remember it completely well, but she went down to the South. She was a white woman, and was standing someplace in protest, and these people showed up, and these white men showed up, and to, you know, quite angry and upset and critical of them, and then proceeded to beat her up a little bit, thinking they would chase her away. So the next day she came back and stood in the same place, and they came and beat her up a little bit more. And the next day she came and stood in the same place, and these people, this one guy was just amazed. You know, what's, you know, and so he came the third time and kind of was going to rough her up, I guess. And this time she looked him in the eye, and they caught each other's eye, and suddenly there was this human connection made. And the white guy was completely, somehow deeply moved, and they stopped and they had a long talk instead of one more, you know. And each time he was, because part of the power of that exchange was the fact that she didn't do anything to defend herself. And she came back and was there standing for what she thought was right. Now, of course, you know, this is not supposed to be an example. We're all supposed to sit there passively and endure whatever is given to us, any suffering. But the tremendous power of the civil rights movement, tremendous power of Gandhi, tremendous power that can happen in appropriate situations of not turning away from suffering but being willing to be there in a way. And not turning away and not, you know, the power of enduring it. So today, I think that's what America celebrates today, is what Martin Luther King stood for. And part of that, what he stood for, came from his willingness to endure suffering, pain, abuse. So the first noble truth, which we talked about last week, is a noble truth about suffering and the importance, at least in the Buddhist spirituality, of being willing to be open to it, to be present for it, not turn away from it, not avoid it. And one of the things I thought about that I wanted to say last week and I forgot is that it's very interesting to pay attention to the subtle sufferings of your life. You know, notice when you're uncomfortable with a situation in subtle ways. Do you say things to people because you're a little bit uncomfortable with the situation, so you want to kind of pretty it over or avoid it? You know, just, oh, that's okay, you'll be okay, or, you know, whatever. What do you do with your eyes when you get uncomfortable? Do you turn away because you feel uncomfortable? What do you do with your hands when you feel a little bit anxious? What happens to you in the subtle sufferings of your daily life? I propose to you that paying attention to those subtle sufferings is one of the gates, one of the doorways into a deeper appreciation, deeper intimacy to the preciousness of being alive. Because when we turn away from suffering, we turn away from ourselves. And my understanding of suffering, the longer I practice, the more I appreciate this, is that all the varieties of suffering that we have, in the ways I talked about it last week, are best seen as little flags that saying, hey, you dummy, pay attention to something here. There's something you need to pay attention to. There's something you need to learn, or something you need to explore, understand. And so suffering, so then from the point of view of mindfulness practice, when we find ourselves being a little bit uncomfortable or majorly uncomfortable or whatever, mindfulness practice is to learn to have the ability to, in a sense, sit still in the midst of that. In a sense, to stop and notice what's happening rather than being reactive to what's happening. To have a kind of stillness in the midst of it. And stillness in Buddhist language, there seems to be a beep. And I'm not suffering particularly, but I want your attention. Is it off? Is it off now? Okay. Where was I? I was suffering. Oh, stillness in the flag. Stillness from a Buddhist point of view means to hold the experience you're having without any reactivity, to hold it with some balance of mind, to hold it without judging it or condemning it, being preoccupied with it, holding it without running away from it or whatever, holding it in the balance of neither pushing nor holding, to find that kind of stillness in the midst of it so we can see wisely what we should be doing and with it. And sometimes, of course, it's to respond back, and sometimes it's to turn away and go walk away from it, or sometimes it's to, you know, it's many different ways to deal with a difficult situation. But the stillness, the openness, the willingness to meet either fully so we can be there in a wise way is a very important part of Buddhist spirituality. So that is a gate to understanding deeply what then the sources of suffering are within us. And the sources of suffering in Buddhist language is always within us. And for those of you here last week, understand why I say that. Because the Buddhist definition of suffering is not pain. And there's many varieties of psychological and physical pain. But suffering from Buddhist point of view is that kind of anxiety, that kind of suffering, that kind of difficulty that arises within us because of the way in which we relate to our experience. So we grasp on and we push away. We don't like what's happening. We want something different, and so we suffer because of it. So by looking at suffering, understanding the kind of suffering that Buddhism is concerned about, understanding the roots of it, the causes of it, the conditions for it within ourselves, then we can see the possible. For one thing, we become more intimate with ourselves. We become closer to ourselves when we do that. But then it's possible then to understand that and become more at ease in the situation. What this means, for those of you, I don't know if you're all interested in this, is that many of us are pursuing happiness in our life or freedom from suffering. But there's many people who are trying to find external solutions to their suffering, things outside of them. From the Buddhist understanding, suffering never has an answer outside of you. Suffering, because suffering, the cause of suffering is from the way in which we push away or hold on to things. And if that's the cause of our suffering, then we can't expect an external agent to help deal with that. An external event might appease it. External event might distract us from it so we feel better. But the roots, the tendencies we have to hate something, to be greedy, to be confused about something it lies within us. So the first noble truth is the truth that says, you know, learn to be comfortable in a sense, learn to be still in a sense, learn to be attentive to suffering when it occurs. And I'm suggesting you can do that with small sufferings of your life. It doesn't have to be always the big ones. And then there's a second noble truth then, which is the truth of the source of suffering. And as many of you know, there's often, it says, you know, people say, well, the source of suffering is desire. And then that raises a flurry of questions. You mean all desire is wrong? So as you know, then I've often then say, well, the literal translation of the word is not desire, but it's craving or thirst. So craving of various sorts is suffering. But I thought about this that week, and I'm always trying to qualify that and try to get back to the real translation of the word. And then I thought that actually, if you're suffering, there's always a desire. If you have a desire, it's not necessarily suffering. So if you find yourself suffering, then you might as well use the word desire. You know, what's the desire? What is it that I want here that is a source for that agitation or that concern or that frustration or that yearning or longing or whatever it might be? But anyway, the literal word is craving or thirst. Now, in Buddhist worldview or understanding, what life is relationships. Life is made up of intimate, infinite number of interactions, interrelationships. Who we are as a human being is a series of relationships that come together and meet with some integrity here. But it's this huge amount of contact we have with other people and the world and nature and aspects of our inner selves that come together to form whatever kind of coherent sense we have of a coherent person right here. That there is nothing independent within us. There's no separate, independent, autonomous aspect of who we are. Everything we are is a result of this, what's called in Buddhism, interdependence of relationships. So that's very central to Buddhist understanding. That everything we do, everything we are, is relationships, is a relationship. The second noble truth is about looking at our understanding what our relationships are. Some of the relationships occur just in the nature of things. But some of the relationships are relationships we choose to enter into. And so what is the relationship we choose to have with the people around us, with our friends, with our other experiences around us? Do we choose to have a relationship of avoidance, of pushing away, of hating, or greed, or wanting, or desire? Or do we choose to have a relationship that's more open-handed, more open-ended, more loving, more sympathetic, more compassionate, more understanding, or whatever? What is the direction of our relationship? What kind of relationship do we have? The difference between desire and craving is that desire can be a simple... There's a lot of wholesome or skillful desires, appropriate desires to have. But the difference between desire and craving is a desire is simply, I don't know, the analogy I have is an open fist and an open hand and a closed fist. A desire can be open-handed. It can be like, oh, if this is what I'd like, and may it be that way. Or this is what I like, and this is what I'm going to try to do or try to attain. And it seems like a useful and wise thing to do. But let events unfold as they will. You know, I'll try to make the conditions just as right as possible to let this happen. But let it happen whatever way it happens. Craving is when that desire is there with a kind of holding tight, and you're demanding this thing. I don't know if I gave you this analogy. I don't know if this bell works, but you know, I'm doing this children's program now on once a month. And today, we had it today. But someone suggested a little exercise you can do with kids. And I haven't done it yet. And that is, if you hold a bell like this, really tight, it doesn't make a very pretty sound. But if you hold it really loosely, and kind of with a soft touch, with light hold, so this is supposed to be a little story for kids about the, you know, grasping versus holding lightly. So what is the relationship we have with desire? Do we have a relationship of desire? Oh, that's more like, you know, a light hold. Oh, this is interesting. This is something I like to do. This is a wish of mine. Or do we kind of demand it, that it has to be that way? So we hold on really tight. The problem is not in the objects of our desire, usually. From the Buddhist analysis, the problem is the way in which we hold that desire. Do we hold it tight, neurotically, or anxiously? Or do we simply kind of, you know, if it may be? So then in the Buddhism, there's a tremendous number of lists to kind of help point out for us some of the various ways in which we can get caught in desires, in cravings. And I don't feel like going into all these lists now exactly, but But I'll just list some of them, just some of the things, rather than discussing them. The classic one that appears on a lot of lists is sensual pleasures. To want sensual pleasures, to want nice sensual experiences, nice food, nice weather, nice clothes, nice friends, nice whatever. And now, it's nothing wrong with wanting that. The question is, how do we hold that wanting? And if your happiness, if your well-being, if your sense of security, if your sense of identity depends on getting those things, then it's likely to cause suffering. But if it's just kind of a simple movement of the heart, simple movement of the body, and without any expectation, it might be fine. So there's sensual desires, sensual pleasures. There's one list of three. There's sensual pleasures, and then there's desire for existence. And that means your own existence and for anybody else's existence. Anything's existence, anything it can be. And then the third one is desire for non-existence. And so both those are problematic in Buddhism. To desire to exist and to desire not exist. They're both problems. There's a way of living life that doesn't require both. There's also craving to a sense of self, to self-identity. There's craving or clinging to opinions, which is supposed to be extremely painful for everybody, especially for other people. And there's craving to there's craving to what's called rites and rituals, or sometimes I like to translate it as ethics and religious practice. And religious practice, you know, Buddhist practice, is supposed to free us from our sufferings, free us from our craving. But sometimes people latch on to ethics or latch on to religious practice as a way of kind of something external that's going to do it for them. And they hold on, they build a whole bunch of expectations around it, and it becomes a source of suffering. The practice that's supposed to free you from suffering becomes, not the source of suffering, becomes the template upon which we throw our, you know, our cravings and our aversions and judgments and despairs and expectations and all these things. So then to understand, to be still in the midst of suffering, is then to begin to look and see, well, what is it that I want here? Or what is it that's happening that I don't want? Not wanting is kind of considered in the same category. Do I want something different than what's here? Do I not want what's here right now? And maybe it's uncomfortable what's happening now. But what is your relationship to that discomfort? And what is your relationship to that thing which is uncomfortable? Those are two different things. What's your relationship to your discomfort? And what is your relationship to the thing that's kind of causing this discomfort? One of the things we can learn is that maybe we'll see is that we're not really reacting to the uncomfortable situation. We're uncomfortable being uncomfortable ourselves. And so we run around in circles and we react because of our inability to kind of simply feel some discomfort within us. And some situations are discomforting. So to see, you know, to see what is it we want? What's happening within us? What are we pulling away from, or what are we latching onto that's causing the suffering right now? And I find it extremely challenging, this idea that Buddhism offers, that that suffering arises from craving, which is our own doing. So if we're suffering, can we be still enough and attentive enough to look within us to see where it is that we're holding? Where it is that we're stuck? Where are we holding things really tight? And is it necessary to do that? Is there a choice? And that's the challenge, because the offering, maybe it's idealistic, but the offering of Buddhism is to become free from all suffering, all kinds of suffering that arises out of the way in which we choose to relate to our experience. And if that's what the offering is, Buddhism is not going to do it for you. You're going to do it by taking it seriously enough to understand what the roots of it are. And some of us, I know, have monumental forms of suffering that go back for years. And is the suggestion of Buddhism valid? Can we find out for ourselves, or is it not valid? Where is the line? And actually, you know, I said last week that the line between, there's a difference between, you know, painful or uncomfortable situations and suffering. Someone dies, it's painful to feel the grief. We break our leg, it's painful. It's kind of suffering. That's not what Buddhism is dealing with. Buddhism is not going to make you free from that kind of suffering. That's called inevitable. But Buddhist practice is about the optional suffering of how we grasp. Now, what's tricky is to know where the line is, because I don't know if there's a clear demarcation between the two. But that's the challenge, is to understand what is our contribution to the situation, so that we don't add or complicate it anymore with our own reactivity. And the opportunity, if we do this, is to become happier, which is a paraphrase of the third noble truth, which we'll talk about next week, the possibility to for the cessation, for the end of suffering, or freedom, or awakening, or whatever. So you can see perhaps why Buddhism, many Buddhist teachers, talk a lot about letting go. Because if clinging, if holding or grasping or craving is a source of so much suffering, it's very easy then to think, well, then just letting go is really the solution. And so there's this famous quote that's sometimes said about Ajahn Chah, a Thai teacher, actually Ajahn Amaro's teacher in Thailand, who's dead now. He said something like, if you let go a little bit, you'll have a little happiness. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of happiness. And if you let go totally, you'll be completely at peace. And so there's a lot of talk about letting go in Buddhism. As probably many of you know, I don't talk a lot about letting go, because it's too easy to let go too soon or inappropriately. And so rather, I'm more keen on the idea of being keenly mindful, looking really carefully, what's actually going on here in the present moment. And then if we look really carefully, we'll understand so well that it's obvious what we have to let go of, and we'll do it kind of naturally. Or even better, if we see something clearly enough, it lets go of itself. And this is kind of where Buddhist practice maybe begins looking like grace or something. It's Buddhist practice kind of enters the mystery of things, because suddenly, if you look carefully enough and things start happening, you let go and you didn't do it. Who did it? So, now it's your turn. Yes?
There's a quote in David White's book, The Heart Aroused, which is a poetry book written for business people. It's a wonderful book. And in the introduction, he talks about the kind of schism between the personality and the soul. And the way he describes it is that the personality's desire is to make things fit the way it perceives it should be. And the soul's desire is to learn through experience just the way it is. And I didn't quote it quite the way it's written, but the essence really struck me, and I've been kind of keeping this in my mind like a mantra, and checking in, with myself, is this my personality, is this my soul's desire to learn through this experience just the way it is, and it's really been useful, and it's captured a lot of meaning for me.
Mm-hmm.
Continually see where I'm coming from, if I'm trying to mold the environment, and am I willing to just be with it, going through it just the way it is.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's nice. There's a saying by Dogen that goes something like delusion or suffering. Delusion is to go forward and impose the self on all things. Awakening or freedom is to let all things come forth to confirm the self. to let all things come forth and affirm you. So maybe it's a little bit similar. Yes.
Somewhere, attention can become wanting. Wanting can become a driven kind of desire. That is, the cessation of desire doesn't entirely capture the question of what intention is about and how that gets realized. Form that intention takes and how that gets realized in the world, and the things we do that bring our intention forth. Anyway, for me, there's confusion around that.
Around intention and
you know, it's not just intellectual confusion, but it's actually experiential.
So let me see, I didn't quite follow the confusion. On the one hand, it's intention, going forth and doing something in the world. And on the other hand, there's the kind of desire, kind of craving or clinging or thirst, which can cause suffering. And you don't see always this difference between the two?
No, because in bringing forth an intention, what will often happen is that we're getting to certain actions and certain doings that impose a will. And somewhere it slides into a willfulness or an oppositional kind of energy.
Uh-huh. So that,
I don't know how clear I'm making myself.
Maybe if I can paraphrase to see if I understand, is that there can be an intention or desire, maybe a healthy one that arises, a natural one, so we can say, so-called. And so then there's following through on that in the world. And once we start following through, it can get fossilized or it can get stuck. And so it no longer becomes simply a movement of desire through you that you're responding to and acting out, but it becomes something that involves craving and desire and opposition and forcing and willfulness, rather than a willingness. And there's a difference between doing something, acting on desire with a willingness, versus acting on desire in a willful way. And that's a great that junction, that meeting point, or that transition point between those two, that's a great place for practice to occur. Maybe that is where practice occurs. So if that's where you're hanging out, congratulations. I mean, that's I don't mean that lightly. I mean, that's actually a very good thing to be studying. But I think, you know, a lot of this we can feel in the body. And one of the reasons I think mindfulness is so useful is mindfulness is not just simply being mindful of the intellectual parts of all this, but mindful of how our body is in relationship to what's going on. And I think often the transition from a willingness around desire and a willfulness and a forcefulness is often can be felt as a transition or change in the body. The body gets tight somewhere. And that then becomes a wonderful barometers of understanding where the difference is. Yes, Holly.
There's about 200 people in the audience, and he goes, "I want to know why 6 million people think they need what they want." Or he sort of leans forward a little bit, and I quote, "He says, 'Because they're fucking out of their mind.'"
So one of the beautiful things about sitting still in the midst of things, you know, what we learn in mindfulness, is we learn you can have a desire and you don't have to act on it. It's okay to, I mean, desires can just float up. You can have all the desires you want. You can float and pass around. But we kind of think that when desire comes, it's us and we have to have it, and sooner the better, and we believe it, you know. And just, oh, there's the interesting one. It's like, a butterfly goes by. Oh, it's a beautiful butterfly. That's a beautiful desire. That's a wild one. Wow. And then you swap desire stories. Oh, I had this great desire today.
I'm always amazed at how much fear in me turns in, or it's related to my wanting, my desiring. And it just, I don't know, I'm wondering if other people have.
What comes first? I mean, we don't have to look for the first cause, but what tends to come first for you? The wanting or the fear?
The fear.
The fear comes,
yes.
And then there's the wanting.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And what does the fear want?
The fear wants something that isn't happening. For example, just tonight I got a new bank card and I went and tried it at the ATM and it didn't work. And I could feel, you know, my body was really, really tense, etc. And I said, what's going on here? You know, and I said, I'm actually feeling afraid. And then I checked back and that, what was I afraid of, etc., etc., etc. That, oh dear, I don't know if I can find the right number to telephone to get this changed. You know, and they had told me they might have made a mistake before, all that, but it's like, that happens so many times with me, is that fear is, comes up there.
But under the fear, so I want to understand a little bit better, so in order for the fear to be there, is there a desire underneath that? Or is there an expectation, or is there a should, or is the...
I guess my desire was to just have this smooth and happen the way I had figured it should happen or something. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's what you're...
So there's a should and expectation that maybe if that's an expectation that you're holding too tightly, and it resonates with other meaning, what it means when things don't go smoothly within you, then the fear arises. And so sometimes, rather than taking certain things like fear just for granted, fear is a kind of suffering. You can ask, what is the desire behind there? What's the should or what's the expectation? Is there something else going on that has to be in place there first that triggers the fear? Yes?
You said a couple of times that you think that Buddhism doesn't... I'm paraphrasing. Buddhism won't help very much with the unavoidable pain. But I think it does.
So tell us how.
When I have pain from grieving or my back really hurts me, and I use the method that I've learned here of let's explore what does it look like and feel like and the color and get into it rather than, oh my God, push it away,
uh-huh.
It alleviates.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, as I say, what we're looking for is to have clean suffering or clean pain. You know, or uncomplicated pain. So if we have some grief or we have some physical pain, just allow it to be there without complicating it with aversion or desire or fear or regret or guilt or embarrassment or whatever. And when we do that, especially if we're giving mindfulness to it, it's almost as if the body's own healing processes, psychological and physical, have an easier time working. So in that sense, maybe if we're talking the same way, in that sense, for sure, the mindfulness practice, in a sense, indirectly, can help very much because it gives our body's processes the optimum chance to do what they're supposed to do. So mostly what we were trying to do is get out of the way. Have clean grief. It's called good grief. Yes.
I have a situation where I have suffered because of someone's action, and I understand that. I still have to continue dealing with this person.
Yes.
And I feel sort of a wound in myself that's healing this incident that occurred. And I guess I'm trying to figure out. I have to be wary of her as a political adversary, which is not my normal stance with people.
Right.
how to not suffer further, how to not suppress feelings, sort of what stance to take.
Well, I don't have an answer. I mean, because it seems like a complicated situation. But I think the better we understand the situation and our involvement in it, our reactivity and our relationships to our feelings, our relationship to the personal, that the clearer it can be for us to know what to do. And so we don't want to take these Four Noble Truths as too idealistically. What we want to do is really take where we're at, and rather than thinking, "Oh, I'm suffering, therefore there's a cause for that. It's some kind of clinging. I'm doing it." And Buddhism is about saying, so ideally I'm supposed not supposed to cling and not supposed to have desires. I'm supposed to be free. And here, what a terrible person I am, and now I'm getting a headache because I think I'm a terrible person I am. Rather, just start where we're at. Don't be idealistic and say, "Well, how is it? This is a really uncomfortable situation." And am I at least willing to kind of be in the discomfort and kind of explore it and kind of at least try to understand it? Or do I keep turning on the television and checking out? And then I go back to work and I just haven't solved anything because I go home and just watch television the whole time. So begin understanding some of the complicated, it could be very complicated, it could be many different things that, within us that complicate the situation. So there might be, for example, some embarrassment, there might be some self-hate because, oh, how could I have been so stupid or whatever, and all those things complicated it. And in the middle of it, there might also be kind of a core sense of pain. This person was disrespectful to me. And that's painful. I mean, that's just kind of, I mean, it's sad and it's, it shouldn't be. But no one wants to, I don't want to take away that kind of pain if someone's actually been disrespectful to you. So it isn't that this is going to take away all your pain, but you need to understand all that and understand the reactions we have to all of it, and then understand the core, perhaps if there is in this situation, a core kind of dissonance between two people, and then know how best to handle that. Does that make sense? I'm just talking. And it's not easy. Practice is not easy. Real life situation, it's not so black and white. You can't just simply say, "Oh, there's suffering and there's a desire. What is it?" And poof, there's lots and lots of things that go into it. And that's why it's important to do this thing called sitting still, to be present and mindful and explore, as Pesha said. Okay, so maybe that's enough. I'll make one more. Well, that's for you to find out. I know that I discovered a similar thing with I told many of you here the story of the headlights, high beams at Skyline where I drive home. Is I noticed I got angry, kind of pissed, why didn't they turn down their high beams driving past me? And so I paid attention to it, and for a long time all I saw was my anger, just be like that. And then I kept paying attention. At some point I saw that as a flash before the anger there was fear. And once I got to see that flash, then from then on I could start seeing the fear. And the fear didn't have to translate into anger. And I could start see that the anger actually wasn't a primal kind of thing. The fear was more primal. But the anger then was a very quick succession of evaluations of what that meant. Oh, this means that this person doesn't respect me, and this person, is a complete, total jerk, and how could they give such a person the driver's license, and all these kinds of, there's all these evaluations, these judgments, these ideas, interpretations of the situation. They get overlaid on top of the fear. And in that situation, for me, that's when the anger arises. So this is not to give you a formula, it can be very interesting to explore what is the evaluation, the opinion, the interpretation that goes into understanding of something, and then what is our relationship to that interpretation. Maybe it's true the person's a jerk. But it's also true that the person just simply forgot. You know, it happens, I forget sometimes. So maybe I'm a jerk, but it just happens, you know. We sometimes forget. And so there can be a softness around the interpretation. Well, maybe it's so, maybe it's not. And if there's a softness, oh, maybe it is. It's just interpretation after all. I don't really know. Maybe the person's rushing off to the hospital and they're about to, you know, whatever. And so they cut me off because, gee, you know, they're about to die. So please, you know, cut me off. You don't know why the person's done what they've done unless you can ask them. So there can be a softness around the interpretation. If we're hard around the interpretation, then it's too easy for it to spin off into other emotions. Does that make sense? So, are we ready to go on to the Third Noble Truth next week? Talk about the end of suffering and happiness and all such things? Or sounds great? Or should we spend another couple of years on the first two?
We will anyway.
We will anyway. Some way or other, we will. Before we go, I actually forgot one announcement, or actually a question. Last August, we invited Wes Nisker to come down and do a one-day retreat. And I was thinking of inviting another teacher to come down this August to do a one-day retreat for us. Because in August, I usually don't do one days for us in Palo Alto. And it occurred to me that to invite Guy Armstrong to come and do a one day on metta. So rather than being a mindfulness retreat, it would be a loving kindness retreat. Is there interest in such a thing?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Then the next thing is we need someone then who will volunteer to host him. It doesn't have to be, it would be nice to know that now before I asked him. Because I'm not going to be around to host him. So someone who can take care of logistics. You'll do that? I don't know the day in August, but you're pretty free, you think?
Yeah, and if I have any.
Well, then we'll ask. Okay. Okay, great. And so, thank you.